At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Good to speak with you this week. Before I introduce the guest, I want to make sure that I thank all of the listeners over the past week, all over the world, and especially in New Zealand and Great Britain, Australia, Sweden, Russia, Norway, and Belgium. Thank you, thank you. Let us know what brings you to the podcast. And for today, we have two special guests returning to the show. Stacy Stukin and Philip DeSlip are joining the show once again to speak about their newest investigative piece on the troublesome boarding schools of the 3HO community. Stacy Stukin is an arts and culture journalist from Los Angeles. She was a contributing editor at Yoga Journal and has also written about yoga for the Los Angeles Times and Time magazine. Over the years, she's had the opportunity to write about Kundalini yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan, including a majorly impactful article for Los Angeles Magazine about the sexual misconduct allegations against Yogi Bhajan and the subsequent reckoning within the 3HO community. Philip DeSlip is a PhD candidate in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and holds an MA from the University of Iowa. He has written articles for several academic journals, including the Journal of Yoga Studies and Tricycle Magazine. Philip was himself a member of 3HO for about a decade after taking a Kundalini yoga class at his undergraduate college in the mid-1990s. He left in 2008 and went on to conduct research into the origins of Yogi Bhajan's Kundalini yoga that culminated in the groundbreaking 2012 article, From Maharaj to Mahan Tantric, for Sikh Formations. You can find links to Stacy and Philip's work, including their newest article, in the show notes of this episode. Here are Stacy and Philip now. I am so happy to be speaking with Stacy and Philip again. It's been a while since we've talked, and I know that each of us has been sort of orbiting around in our worlds doing research and collecting more data and stories, and the things that you have zeroed in on are incredibly powerful, important, exposing, and I think really reassuring to the people who went through the things that we're going to talk about today to know that people care. People care about what happened to them. And that hopefully this will be a cautionary tale for other people who are getting involved in things or who are running things like this. I know I'm being cagey because I wanted to come from you, but because I know part of what we're going to be talking about today, but I really value your dedication to this work and to the people who have been victimized in what should be lovely, spiritual, and safe environments and have been everything but. So if you don't mind taking a moment and just reintroducing yourself to our audience, especially for people who didn't get a chance to hear the first interview with you, and we'll be sure to link it to this show as well so people can hear it. But Stacy, you want to start?
My name is Stacey Stukin. I am a Los Angeles-based journalist. I cover wellness, art, and culture. And over the years, I have reported on Riecho and Kundalini Yoga. Philip and I started collaborating, and since then, we've written a series of investigative pieces and also presented at a number of academic conferences on this topic.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. And Philip, go ahead, introduce yourself, please.
My name is Philip Dieslip. I am currently a doctoral candidate in the Department of Religious Studies at UC Santa Barbara. My research and writing focuses on Asian metaphysical and marginal traditions in modern America. In 2012, I wrote an article for the academic journal Sick Formations that, for the first time, with a lot of evidence, uncovered the actual sources of Yogi Bhajan's Kundalini Yoga. I thought naively that that would be the end of it. And then in 2020, all hell broke loose. And during that hell breaking loose, I got to know Stacey through her reporting for the Los Angeles Magazine piece. We've been collaborating since. We've got an article for the Newswire Religion News Service and two long-form investigative pieces for Canada's Boz News.
Really incredible, incredible. And you are a dynamic duo. Together, you put together really quite amazing things with a melding of your investigative styles, but also your interests in and the research that you've done into these different kinds of communities. And I think, you know, also Stacey talking about wellness, we could talk about that, you know, for a long time, you know, the billion-dollar industry that it is, so much fraud and snake oil salesmen and saleswomen. You know, I have worked and I am working with a number of people who have been in 3HO, many of whom can't even utter the name Yogi Bhajan. They need to say YB or give him some other name. That's often choice words, because it is so traumatizing just to hear the sound of his name, not even the sound of his voice. So you can only imagine some of the things that took place there and some of the things that took place under his watch, or seemingly under his watch. There are also a lot of people who have come forward who are in like Hare Krishna schools where they talk about rampant abuse and no one watching. And so these sorts of things can happen. They don't always, but they can, and sometimes can be real, you know, hellish places, as you've used, you know, in terms of your terminology for these places. So I'm curious where you would like to begin. I know also that there's been a court case and the effort to do reparations. It's caused a lot of infighting and competition, a kind of ugliness to come through. And before handing it back to you, one of the things that I talked about on this podcast, I've talked about it before and I did a bonus episode on it, is about the infighting among people who have been harmed within cults, and that there can be this sense of dissenting views, and that you're supposed to somehow, even after you've been hurt and you're leaving, you're supposed to be still thinking about it the quote unquote right way, or that you're still supposed to believe in the teachings, but not the teacher, or you're supposed to still adore and believe in the teacher, but not the teachings. So there are all these sort of divisions of different groups, and it's hard for some people to stay out of this melee, and others get drawn in, and it really is draining for everyone. And I don't know if they realize that this is sort of an extension of the cultic environment, the infighting that they were raised with and the competitive spirit that they were unfortunately raised with, you know. Anyway, so Philip, let me hand it back to you. Tell me where you would like to begin the conversation.
I think probably the best place to start, and also for the benefit of any of your listeners who are coming for the first time to the subject, is to begin with Yogi Bhajan and the organization that grew up around him. Because I don't think you can really understand what happened to the men and women born into the organization, or why things happened the way they did, without really knowing the structure of it. So in brief, in late 1968, a former customs officer from Delhi's Palam Airport, named Harbhajan Singh Puri, comes to Los Angeles by way of Canada. And we know now that he came to California from Canada because he got a yoga student pregnant and was fleeing. So when he arrives in Los Angeles, from people who knew him firsthand, he wasn't quite sure what to do. And then he very quickly realized that he could do very well for himself as a yoga guru. So he starts telling these kind of wide-eyed hippie spiritual seekers that he was teaching a form of yoga that he called Kundalini Yoga that was previously secret and very powerful and never been taught in the open before. So, of course, his students gravitate towards him. And very quickly, he starts kind of franchising his yoga. He sends students quickly away from Los Angeles to establish ashrams and yoga centers of their own. So within a year, year and a half, you have centers throughout the country and incorporates this healthy, happy, holy organization, or 3HO. In late 1970, early 1971, as he's has this growing number of students, he takes about 80 of them to India. And then the organization kind of makes an abrupt turn. Yogi Bhajan has a falling out. He's been known as Yogi Bhajan by his students. Yogi Bhajan has a falling out with one of his teachers. And he quickly rebrands his students while in India as Sikh converts and himself as a Sikh missionary. And when he comes back to the United States, he also claims this title of Mahan Tantric, a singular master of Tantric yoga. And then as Stacy and I discovered in our reporting for our previous piece for Boz News, in 1973, he incorporates his form of Sikhi with the state of California, and he claims a title, Siri Singh Sab, or Chief Administrator of Sikhism in the Western Hemisphere. This is absolutely crucial because with that title and with that religion, he forms a type of corporation known as a corporation soul. And that allows someone holding a title to singularly control the assets of a religious organization. So through this title and through his religious organization, Yogi Bhajan is able to control businesses that are donated to Sikh Dharma, the inheritances that are donated to Sikh Dharma, the properties that his students live in. So he really has this extensive material control over the lives of his students. And he's also looked upon as an infallible spiritual leader who is a Sikh religious authority, who is a yoga master, who's a master of tantra. So he's really looked to as the definitive voice for everything. And he gives them a prescriptive lifestyle where he tells them how to do everything from how to have sex with your spouse, how to bathe in the morning, how to dress, what to eat, where to work.
Yeah, my goodness. Right. So many words that are, I mean, that really pop out at me when people are talking, and because I see where there are going to be major pitfalls if someone wants to take advantage of them. The one that stood out because of the work that I do was infallible. And so whenever you're dealing with that kind of personality where they are just perfect and never wrong, then, you know, you learn to not question them, but especially if you're born and raised in the group. And now I think even for some people who are leaving or who have left, it's still hard for them to see him as a human being and a very flawed human being. Okay, thank you, Philip, for that. Take it away, Stacy.
Well, I think you both brought up an interesting point when you talk about Yogi Bhajan as an infallible leader. People born into the organization who we've spoken to described him almost like as a grandfather. He had more authority over them than their parents. So particularly when you're talking about the boarding schools, for example, you know, if he told their parents that they're not capable of raising them and that they're too neurotic and that they needed to leave the corrupting influences of America and go to India, it was verboten not to, you know, obey that request. And I think that's where it gets super complicated, because it's very easy to just lay the blame at the feet of Yogi Bhajan, but there were plenty of people around him enabling it. And in many ways, often parents. You know, the abuse was in plain sight. I mean, Philip, we've talked about this before. You know, children would come home from India visibly having lost a lot of weight. They had lice. They were dirty. You know, sometimes their personalities had changed a little bit. But they were sent back year and year again.
Right, because there was no question, right? And then there was nowhere else for them to go. This was the place where they were going to be able to get the education or the spiritual education, supposedly, that they're supposed to get, or it was going to make Yogi Bhajan happy, maybe, with them or with the family that they sent their kids there. Right, right. And to jump into what you're saying, Stacey, with the people who I've talked to who say that they remember being brought into Yogi Bhajan's bedroom when they were young, young girls especially, and having to file by parents, sometimes grandparents in the group, a man who was a psychologist, who was a member, who knew where these girls were being taken. And no one did anything. And I think the message in that for these girls especially, that's not to say that boys were not abused. They were abused, neglected. Everything happened to them too. But the message was there's no protection, or that maybe this is right. Because if it were wrong, there's some adult who would try to stop it. And so it's a very, very confusing message. But also when I think of great loneliness when you're being abused there.
I wanted to just back up a little bit. You know, when Yogi Bhajan is kind of creating this organization, there's a lot of things inherent to it that feed into the abuse. So Yogi Bhajan creates a very hierarchical structure, which is very different than Sikhism throughout the world. He creates ministers and, you know, the equivalent of bishops. He also promises his students that not only does he have powers, but his students can gain powers. And so closer you are to him, the more material and spiritual power you have. He also is undercutting parental authority at every step. He is telling parents that they are screwed up, they're neurotic, they're going to ruin their children's lives, that their children are going to grow up to hate them because of their own neurosis. And there's also, when he is kind of taking over people's homes and inheritances, there is an incredible amount of apocalyptic fervor. He is telling his students, American society is going to collapse. Everyone is going to be insane. There are going to be cataclysmic changes in the climate. He's also promising his students that they are going to be these leaders of the Aquarian age, that they are destined to lead humanity, and that their children have an even more special destiny. That is, their children are these perfect little saints and yogis that they can risk screwing up if they parent them wrong. So a lot of seeds for further abuse are really sowed early on within the organization. One person that we spoke to said bluntly, once someone has arranged your marriage, which control do you have of your life? And I mean, you could take that further. If like someone is telling you how to dress and you're following it, you know, you've already kind of lost the plot there.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, I've been on camera or sometimes in person with people who are changing their look and want to do it either with me present or other people present, or show me their new hair, like the women who've gotten their hair cut maybe shorter, which was also verboten, going back to your words, Stacey, or just uncovering your head and wanting to go through that moment of abject fear and doing that and then seeing that nothing's happening. That you haven't been struck dead, that, you know, that there isn't some sort of penance you need to pay for kind of emerging as yourself in the world, separate from the group. But I'm glad that you brought this up about how parents are really guided to feel like they are helping their children by stepping aside, by not being attached, by not watching really what's happening. And it's a very clever way of relegating them as second tier and having Yogi Bhajan be the one, the parent, I guess, to all, even though he had no awareness, as we've come to see, about child development and what's healthy and how to raise children who are also emotionally healthy and without abuse. And there was no sense of that, even though he was deferred to as the parent, which is such a shame, but happens over and over again. So yeah, if you can talk about the case and the reparations, that would be great, because I know that's been something ever present in the last few years for former members.
Actually, I think maybe we should back up one more time. Sorry. Define the philosophy, or name it, of the parenting philosophy, which was known as distance therapy. So even that alone, the language that's used, you know, having interviewed first generation women talking about how hard it was for them to suppress their maternal instincts, and they did it anyway. And even before the boarding schools, there was an encouragement to separate parents from children. Children were sent away sometimes as young as 17 months old to live with other families across the country. And this would begin, you know, years of distance from their parents. For example, one mother described having not seen her child for, you know, over a year. And she shows up at summer solstice and she kind of sees him at the side of the road looking kind of lost and forlorn. And he doesn't recognize her.
And within 3HO, when you go back to their publications and the lectures, there's a very unsettling insertion of familial terminology from the very beginning. So they're referring to 3HO as the 3HO family. 3HO members refer to each other as siblings of destiny. We are all sons and daughters of Guru Gobind Singh. And then in some of the periodicals, they're talking about how we're a community. So your children are my children. My children are your children. It's kind of this almost radicalizing of kind of hippie communal thought. And so it's an added step towards justifying sending your kids away. We're all one family. You know, we all love each other's children. Why not? What's the harm that could come from it?
Right. Right. Yeah, it certainly softens the message, and it betrays really the reality of the situation by using this lovely, connected, gentle language of family, of siblings, and of destiny too, that this is your destiny. And these are very powerful. And I think terms that are going to be used as part of emotional manipulation, there's no question. They're purposely chosen. Okay. Anything else though about the parents before we move on? Anything else about those relationships or stories that you remember hearing just about parents needing to move away from their kids when the kids needed them, or how they came back into their kids' lives and what that was like?
In our reporting on the abuse at the boarding schools, there were several things that kept coming up from different sources. Children who were born into 3HO were sent to Indian boarding schools beginning really in 1981, when the first kind of sizable group of them is sent over. They go through a series of boarding schools. In the early 80s, there's a place called Guru Nanak Fifth Centenary School, GNFC. In the late 80s, early 90s, they then go to another boarding school in northern India, Guru Ram Das Academy. And then in the mid-90s, 3HO establishes its own boarding school in Amritsar called Mary Peary Academy. There are just a host of abuses and forms of neglect that happen at all of these boarding schools. And the big question, as Stacey kind of alluded to, is why did it take until 2020 for this to come out? A big reason is, horrifyingly, it was kind of an open secret. The title of our Boz piece comes from a direct quote from Yogi Bhajan. He tells parents, these schools are going to be a living hell. They're going to be horrible, but it's going to toughen the kids up. It's going to prepare them for tomorrow. So, I mean, at a very basic level, it's very difficult to claim ignorance about what happened in the schools because it's openly stated that they're supposed to be terrible. We also heard from numerous second-generation adults that Yogi Bhajan was telling the parents, your kids are going to complain. They're going to make up stories. Children at the boarding schools were also copying down their letters home from the blackboard. So they're all getting these very sanitized, life is great, this is wonderful. But I think even more important, as we discovered in our reporting, is there was a culture of secrecy, of not going to outside authorities. You know, above all else, abuse was kept internal. It wasn't reported. It was quieted. So, you know, it does kind of come out in this very explosive way, but also it's a very known secret for decades. People from rank and file parents all the way up to senior ministers and Yogi Bhajan himself, 3HO therapists and community leaders. It's known by so many people and nothing is ever done about it.
Aren't people supposed to be mandatory reporters? Isn't that part of their licensure?
Oh, yeah. Anyone who is licensed, who is a therapist, who is a teacher, who is a nurse or a doctor. I mean, there are a lot of people, clergy, who are reporters. And so, right, I mean, that is something that is unethical. It's illegal to just stand by while something like this happens. And it's very frustrating to hear how many opportunities there could have been for kids being saved and protected, where everyone kind of folded. Everyone was just in this passive mode of, I think, wanting to believe that this was a blessing in people's lives. Or, you know, I think some of the language even was able to be useful. The language of that's manipulative was able to be useful in calling off the dogs, where a psychologist, if he or she is told that this isn't Yogi Bhajan having sex with girls, this is him imbuing them with something spiritual, or them feeling specially chosen, or this is what happens a lot in some of these groups, this is their karma, and so this is benefiting them, and I'm not going to get in the way of something that's for their benefit. So I think the language shifts the interpretation, and the interpretation shifts the emotional response. But still, it is true that it is illegal to be passive when something like that is happening. You have to be so persuaded to see it a completely different way, that it's not happening to the person, but it's happening for the person.
I think one of the most devastating things that we found in our reporting was the consequences of that kind of silence. You know, we uncovered that there were at least 5 pedophiles within 3HO. And in some of these cases where their abuse continued for decades, you have genealogies of abuse where pedophiles abuse a child, that child goes on to abuse other children, those children go on to abuse other children. It's like a horrifying tree, where you have dozens of people's lives who are deeply damaged because one person's abuse goes unchecked. It's hushed up. No one wants to go to the authorities. No one wants to bring shame on the community or regional heads or heads of 3HO itself give the directive to not go to the police, to keep it quiet.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, it's a question that I get asked a lot, and sometimes it's hard to answer it in a clear-cut way. Do these groups kind of spawn sociopathy and a lack of boundary when it comes to anything, really anything? And the kind of the pedophilia that comes not necessarily from coming from inside of you, but that was the model, that's somehow okay. And again, for someone's benefit. And so do these groups attract those kinds of personalities, or do they create them? Or is it a little bit of both? because I do know there are a number of people who have not been able to be in society because their proclivities cause them to be watched or arrested, but they find their unfortunate playground, basically the place they can do anything, within cultic systems. And others where after they've left, they said they've had to learn like that, for example, I'm going back to women, even though abuse happens of men and boys, but I've heard this specifically where people have left particular groups who are born male, and they will say, I had to learn that someone who is female is a human being, that they have things that are equal to me, that they have rights, they have emotions. I had no idea. And I was also taught to ignore them. And the women were often taught to ignore their own, you know, they didn't share their emotion, which just fortified this sort of worldview of the other gender not having emotions. There are people who are so confused, not even quite sure where to begin, and want to be able to be a good person, however that's defined, as separate from the group, and don't even sometimes know where to begin. It's all a very disturbing picture. And so I wonder also then, you know, going back to what you were saying, Stacey, about how it took for this person to come forward for all these other people to pour out their stories. That is often the case. And that's why it's hard to be the first, because you are coming into a space not knowing how much damage you're going to have to incur, sort of personal attacks and being isolated, being blamed. If your family's going to drop you, if you're not going to be believed, if you're just going to hear crickets. And there is something very powerful and gratifying when it connects with the Me Too movement of its own. And people were just waiting for someone else to be first. But there is a great delay in telling the story when you don't know to trust your own memory, to trust your own instincts. You don't know that it's even okay for you to feel angry about what happened, because you're supposed to avoid feeling that or ignore feeling that. Or you might still want to believe that what happened there was done innocently because it's too hard to look at that you were treated that way and no one actually cared. I'm sure there are a lot of other reasons that people have delayed coming forward, as you've probably found out about.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the reparations and how it all began, I guess, and what's happened since it began.
As we discovered, reparation programs are kind of a new animal. There's not a long precedent or track record for them. They've really kind of become more common over the last 5 years or so. So in theory, what a reparations program can do is it can allow for survivors to receive some kind of settlement outside of the court system. And very often reparations programs like to use trauma-informed language so that survivors don't have to go through a lengthy and re-traumatizing court process, have to testify. They can go through reparations. Also, in a very real way, reparations programs sometimes allow for survivors who would not be able to seek recourse through the courts because of what happened to them or statutes of limitations to get something. The benefit for an organization is that they don't have to go through court. They're not compelled to provide evidence. People don't have to testify under oath. And what often happens in these programs is that in order for survivors to receive their settlements, they have to sign away their ability to sue the organization. So in a very idealized sense, a reparations program can be this kind of restorative process where survivors get some kind of settlement. In a very kind of jaded way, you can see these programs as a way for organizations who are responsible for abuse to avoid a day in court and to make their problems go away, often at a very cheap rate. So the reparations program was announced for 3HO. And what our reporting uncovered is that the number of claimants, Stacey and I were both stunned that no one saw this coming, Everyone seems to have been surprised by how many claims were filed. Our sources said that there was an original estimate of maybe 100 claims, and in the end, there were nearly 600 claims.
Wow.
It's a running joke among the sociologists and anthropologists that have studied 3HO that 3HO has always been about 3,000 to 5,000 members. 3HO loves to inflate their numbers, but 3HO has never really been bigger than 3,000 to 5,000 people, depending on how you count membership. I mentioned in an article for The Revealer that the stable numbers of 3HO are very telling because an organization that encourages people to get married and have children, an organization that is constantly appealing to outsiders through the yoga, numbers should be going up, growing over time. And the fact that those numbers are stable means that they are constantly shedding members. So 3HO is not that big, maybe 3,000 to 5,000 people. And one of the sources that we spoke to said, because so many second-generation adults are off the grid, suffered from addiction, were in prison, many committed suicide. If you were able to do a complete outreach, you would probably have closer to 1,000 claims. And that's not only a big number, but that also means that it's an extraordinarily high percentage of men and women who grew up in the group suffered enough to file serious claims about abuse and neglect. That's a devastating number. We're not talking about isolated incidents or a bad apple here or there or a small percentage, but we're talking about a sizable number of everyone raised within the group.
Yeah, that is a huge number in comparison. So thank you for that. So we can get the kind of relativity of it. And what I think is, hearkening back to what you were saying about, Yogi Bhajan saying, yeah, it's going to be hellish or the school or whatever else. So, like, there was sort of a acceptance of suffering as part of growth, as you were saying that he quoted. He didn't suffer at all, of course, and people had to meticulously make his meals exactly as he wanted and preparing them for hours on end when other people were starving. But I think he just decided to not care about people suffering or to give it a spin where it was for people's growth and spiritual benefit. So with that as the umbrella, yes, you're going to have a lot of suffering that people, I think, don't realize is suffering at the time until they start to, I think, hear how that's defined, which is also one of the reasons that sometimes it's helpful to have a court case or a lawsuit, because you get to see that the thing you experience that's causing you nightmares or that caused you to have, physical issues growing up or delay, certain kind of growth hormone or getting your period, that was called something, that that's neglect, that that's endangerment, that that's abuse. And then you can know what happened to you, which I think is very helpful.
Yeah. And I think there was for a long time, and, even some of the people that we interviewed for this story, in some ways they would say, well, it wasn't that bad. But when you contextualize it and realize that, parents were spending a decent amount of money to go to a boarding school that had poor infrastructure, crappy food, not a great education, no emphasis on college counseling, and more of an emphasis on getting your yoga teaching credential. And so even within the second generation, it's different opinions.
Right. Right. Yeah. I'm sure you heard a lot of stories about the boarding school. And I do want to have people hear more about that. I know just even hearing, there was no air conditioning in India in the summer. I just can't imagine, and no doctors and really nothing. And with going back to the case and reparations, if you can take us through how that has morphed or what's happened, what's sort of the latest with it that you know about?
Well, the program is complete. The claims have been settled. And it was, I think initially there was some hopefulness. I think both in, and you could probably speak to this more, but psychologically that maybe finally parents, community would come forward and apologize, you know, because in addition to the monetary requests, there was a whole list of non-monetary requests for institutional change, safeguarding at the school. But it's done now.
For so many of the claimants that we spoke to, they described it as almost an inversion of what they thought they were getting into. They were told it was an open-ended, uncapped, trauma-informed process that would include all kinds of non-monetary requests. And for many of the people we spoke to, that was the most important thing. It wasn't about the money, at least not the money itself, but it was about finding out what happened, getting some kind of accountability and transparency, instituting basic safeguards, background checks, reporting, knowing what had happened, getting an apology. And over the course of the reparations program, there was a limit on settlement amounts. It was very re-traumatizing. And as far as we know, little any of those non-monetary requests were honored. And it seems like the only side in this whole process that made out better was 3HO itself. You know, they drastically diminished the potential number of people who could file a lawsuit against them. And in the end, the number of claimants, even if they didn't sign away their rights to sue, they're exhausted. They're re-traumatized. They don't want to go back to it again. And I think it's telling that, you know, at least in public, we don't really know of any claimant or second generation adult who gives an unqualified endorsement of the program. There's no one there saying, thank God this happened. I feel so much better now. Now I can look forward to the future. There's a lot of unhappiness, a lot of disappointment. And, you know, some of the strongest endorsements we've heard of the program were people saying, well, I have some money that I can do some things with.
And I should also note that we've noticed that since the reparations program has ended, that now, particularly with the yoga, it's just full steam ahead. Kundalini yoga for, you know, for healing trauma. Yogi Bhajan's name is being used again.
Wow. Incredible. I mean, incredible and not, because, you know, that there's a short memory, shorter than we'd like, for things like this, where someone is in the news for a period of time as having been a horrible person in a lot of ways. And then, you know, they can have their reputation kind of laundered, I guess, by it being used in connection with a healing practice. And people just sort of go along with it to a certain degree, especially ones who don't know. But you can tell that there are people who still want to use his name, people who probably believe in him and might just think that something went awry with the organization or at the hands of the membership. It's very betraying.
You know, it might be a fool's errand for three of us to look at it like an academic, a reporter, and a therapist, because there are standards and there's a kind of holding to the facts. If you're trying to sell yoga to the public, the only standard you have to follow is what your potential customers will believe. That's it. Your only burden of proof is, you know, what you need to tell people to sign up for your next teacher training. That's it. And I mean, I think one really sobering thing that we kept coming across is, you know, a lot of the yoga, wellness, new age community is extraordinarily self-centered. At the end of the day, it really is about my experience, you know, my healing journey, what's going to happen to me. And that's really true, even to the exclusion of denying the yoga came from a serial rapist, or the organization oversaw the abuse of hundreds of children. For a lot of people, that's just not enough to really dissuade them. They like doing the yoga. The yoga makes them feel good. Find a way to justify it. And it's been particularly shocking to see the same people who 3-4 years ago, you know, were crying on their webcams, hashtag I believe women, they're back. They're back. They're doing teacher training. Come to my trauma-informed workshop.
Wow. Wow. Incredible. Incredible. So when you talk about people really being self-motivated and that they are on their own, as you say, journey, and they're going to not feel, I guess, encumbered by things that are morally conflictual. Yes, that is different than the way the three of us operate in the world. And it is very difficult to see. That is something that I've seen a lot. There is this distancing. It's almost like sometimes the difference between when you're talking to a psychotherapist and a social psychologist, like there is a just let's look at it. And we don't necessarily respond in an emotional way, even though I think social psychologists probably have more emotions than they might let on when they're doing their studies. But still, having that feeling of separation where it gets sort of you can kind of cleanse it in your own mind and just move on. No, that would be way too hard for me to do.
There's the whole, yeah, but it was great, man. Meaning so many people who are in the first gen who, instead of saying, I helped build this thing that did horrible things to children, instead it was, yeah, but the music was really groovy. Yeah, but we were great Sikhs, but I really believed in it. But the yoga was great, but we did this. There just seems to be, in general, this huge ability to avoid the reality of what happened. I mean, could you imagine, you know, the people behind, you know, Native American residential schools saying, yeah, but, you know, it was a really beautiful school. I mean, you know, the classrooms were just fantastic. Did you ever go there, South Dakota? Like, it was a beautiful landscape. How could that even be fathomable? But yeah.
Right. Oh my goodness. No. No. Mm-mm. So, you know, with you bringing up these stories about things that happened in the schools and now with the cases and just, you know, how jumbled it all is, how unhealthy it all was and continues to be in some people's lives. In fact, I know some people who weren't sent to the schools in India and still feel bad about themselves that they didn't get to go, even though they know all the stories, but that they were kind of looked down upon because of it.
Probably the most horrifying bit of an interview that I did was with someone who was sexually abused as a child, and they talked about their friends coming back from India. They didn't get sent to India. And they actually had this back and forth of, well, I was sexually abused in America, but at least I didn't get the hell beaten out of me in India. I'm not really sure which was better or which was worse. At least I didn't get beaten in India, but people got beat in India. At least they didn't get sexually molested here.
Wow. Yeah. I'm sure in an interview like that, there is this period of silence where you're thinking, I don't even know how to handle what the emotions I'm having inside of me to be able to respond to that moment. You can see the level of detachment, of desensitization to abuse too. Like, yeah, mine happened, but it wasn't as bad as this and it wasn't as bad as that. And so I think, you know, when we talk about healing from these kinds of experiences, one of the things, as you were saying about the case that I think has been re-traumatizing has been being given false hope about something happening, about being gifted with something, about life being made easier, about someone finally taking responsibility and or apologizing and saying, here, let me gift you with something to make up for it. And when that doesn't happen, and instead, there's a reduction of what you're going to get. And then there's the kind of infighting around it. It goes back to something that a lot of people have to deal with when they leave cultic groups, which is that they don't know how to base their value on something. On, you know, before it was based on the leadership and doing what the leader said. And then with a court case with reparations, if someone gets more money than someone else, does that mean that their abuse was of more value? There's just so many times that I think people feel weighed and measured in terms of if they have the right to even feel what they're feeling. And so people who come out of 3HO, not unlike other groups, are very uncomfortable, first of all, with feeling anger, with feeling sadness, and with feeling deserving of happiness. And they're going to base that based on how much they sacrificed and how much they endured. And now, are they deserving of a happy life? So just the relationship to happiness is something that people need to work on and feel comfortable with. There was also, there are big issues with attachment disorders. So we touched on that in terms of parent-child relationships. And when you are needing to forfeit your role with your own children, then your children experience having a caregiver who steps aside. And then how do you attach yourself to people and feel secure in that attachment as you get older? And some of the things that I work on with people is helping them see that there are different issues with attachment, different styles of attachment, and what has impacted it, and also how you can step into a relationship with more confidence if you feel like you are, first of all, addressing some of the confusion and the losses and the abandonment from early years, but also how you can evaluate someone else to see if they really are present, if they're reliable, if they're mature enough to handle a good and solid relationship with you. So how you make those judgment calls. There's also issues around trust, who you can trust, because the people you should have been able to trust the most, you could trust the least. And that the world outside was supposedly this place where you couldn't trust anyone, but people will very often tell me when they left, that's when they experienced their first true kindness. And so I think the other issue is just with self-care, that it's okay to sleep enough, whatever enough means, and how to define enough. Because when you have to go without, when you have deprivation, when you have food insecurity, sleep insecurity, health insecurity, all of it, you think just because you're not tremendously ill on a particular day, you're fine. But that's not fine. That's just not being very ill. So just having a frame of reference for what health feels like and what it looks like and what enough sleep feels like and what enough food feels like, and that it's not you being gluttonous or whatever it is, but it's you responding to your body. Part of the work also that I do is having people listen to their body and listen to their mind and honor it and know that it's guiding them and that it needs to be listened to, and they shouldn't forfeit those messages, whether they're physiological or emotional, to give it over to someone else to decide if it's right for them to be feeling this way. I think the other thing that a lot of people deal with is fear, that there are people who do have a lot of sleep disorders coming out of this group, and they have nightmares, especially ones who went to the school who at a young age had no safe place and safe person to comfort them. And so they learn to be fiercely independent, but not healthily so. Part of the challenge for some people coming out of this group is remembering to ask for help and knowing who your sources of help are. Who's your team? Who's your team for emotional health, physical health, and also how to adult, how to balance a checkbook, how to get a job that's not part of Yogi Tea or whatever else, and also how to enjoy rest. How long can you just put your feet up without it being sinful? And sort of redefining again how you can, especially if you're sick, that you can take a day off of work. And that's okay, because that was never allowed. You know, you could be having given birth that morning and you're back working, you know, by the afternoon. So just the overall sense that you matter, and it's okay that you matter. And it's not putting yourself above everyone else in the world. It's just putting yourself as potentially an equal to some of the people in your world. It is possible to get past these experiences if you do a couple of things. If you meet with someone who's a true trauma-informed therapist, someone who knows about cults, if you also have a chance to talk to other people who have been in these situations. That's why I run support groups for this reason, so that you don't feel tragically alone and isolated. But also, having things defined for you, what abuse is, what neglect is, what you endured, and what you should never have to endure again, and what to do with your anger about it and your resentment, and how to feel comfortable with expressing those feelings and not be afraid of them. A lot of people are afraid that the first time they really let out a scream of anger, that that anger is going to overtake them and they'll never get past it. And that's not the case. And I don't know if there are other particular questions that you had for me, looking at things psychologically in terms of healing.
I mean, I think a lot of people that we spoke to, like the boarding schools and 3HO itself, were corrupt, abusive structures. And so many people that we talked to, they're both abused and victim, but also the abuser and the victimizer. Like kind of boarding school or abusive hierarchical situation. And I think my own opinion is that's one of the reasons why it was so, well, this, all of this was so long in coming out, because as much as people wanted to talk about what happened to them, there's also the guilt of, I heard someone getting beaten up at the boarding school and I didn't do anything about it. If I talk about what happened to me, will people talk about what I did to them? And I think that was one of the, what we found, that was one of the big kind of differences in the whole series of boarding schools, that by the time you get to Mary Peary in the 90s, it really becomes this institutional revolving door where people, once they graduate, they come back. The people who are in charge have no qualifications except they went through the schools themselves. It becomes this weird echo chamber where everything just becomes normal. That's just the way that it is. I mean, we talked to people who said, you know, the adult in charge of me was the kid from the graduating class 1 or 2 years ahead of me. 19-year-olds watching after 17-year-olds with no experience, no training, no degree.
Yeah. So right. I think this is a very good point, that there are a lot of people who come out of horribly unhealthy systems, feeling that they're not deserving of good things happening to them because they somehow played a part in maintaining the system that was unhealthy, that was abusive. They had to play a role in abusing others, or they didn't know that's not the way to treat people because that was the only way they've ever been treated. And it was provided in the context of, this is to help keep you on the right path. So there are some people who would unleash their abusiveness, sometimes because they really thought they were helping, other times because they were so distraught, so angry, that it became that they would take it out on the people around them. They had no one else to take it out on. They couldn't go talk to the people who had done these things to them. So it gets displaced and misplaced on the victims. Many cults will have people do grooming and bring people into a system that's sexualized, or that they're used to recruit for a group, even if they know there's abuse taking place there. It's very important for people to learn how to absolve themselves if what they were doing was surviving. If they knew that they had to recruit, or they had to groom, or they had to hit someone so that they weren't hit sometimes so hard that they wouldn't be able to function. And so when you're caught in a system where you are pushed to do things or allowed to do things that are ultimately against your conscience, then you're dealing with a very sick system. It's not that you are, but that you are a cog in the wheel of this horrible system. So to take a sense of fault out of it, you can still hold on to the responsibility, but not the fault, because the fault started outside of you and you were pushed. And it's like taking someone's piece of bread when there's only one piece of bread left and you're going to starve unless you take it. And there are a lot of people who are put in these situations. And what you want to look at is someone who feels guilty, who might want to reach out to that person they took the bread from, might want to send them an apology letter, might want to say how tremendously sorry they feel, but you want to then take it away from them because they were victims of the system, and look at who put them in a situation where there was only one piece of bread left between two people. And so to redirect their focus outward while still doing what they think they need for their conscience to do, And sometimes it does mean reaching out, whether another person wants to hear from you or not, but to be able to say that you're sorry, be able to say the things that you would wish the adults had said to you. So I think sometimes people do want to apologize, to take responsibility, but I think it is very important for them to be very clear about how the problem didn't originate inside of them, and that we really want to look at how adults did this to them and back them into this corner.
There were also numerous reports of medical neglect. You know, several sources who said, I think I might have had broken ribs, or I think I might have had strep throat. And I think there's also a kind of, maybe not direct form of abuse or neglect, but many people we spoke to talked about not being prepared for the outside world, not being prepared for college, not being prepared for careers, not being prepared in any kind of healthy way to have a family or, you know, have a normal, healthy sex life or interpersonal relationships. I think it's important to like really specify that 3HO is kind of outside mainstream American culture, but it's also outside of mainstream Punjabi Sikh culture. So it really is in this weird limbo where people we spoke to said, I couldn't relate to American kids my age. We certainly weren't like the Punjabi Sikhs in India. We were just this weird little third entity. And I think that's part of the revolving door, is there was so little preparation for that outside world or just normal college that I think by default, that's, you know, you go back to the boarding school, you go back to the community because you don't have to explain yourself. It makes sense. No one's going to ask you weird questions.
Right. Yeah. It's so isolating when you know that your life exists on an island unto itself. And you find that out when you try to integrate and it just is not able to happen. And right, people gravitate towards what's familiar, but especially if there aren't other places for them to connect and feel okay and feel quote unquote normal. Right. So there weren't credentialed teachers, and there also weren't teachers about life. And so there's a handicap nature, I think, to a lot of people who come out of this, who have had to learn the basics and how to get along, how to ask a question, even how to find out about a whole variety of things. And when you are of a certain age, you just don't know who you can ask, who might think it's not very odd that you don't know that yet. So it's very Lord of the Flies too. And I am so happy that you are willing to dive into this. This is an uncomfortable space, but a very important space. And when you highlight the things that have happened, and I'm sure there are more things too, but of the things that you mentioned, anyone listening who went through something like that would now know that you know. And it's very powerful for someone else to know that their experience is being acknowledged, their experience of abuse, of neglect, and also, as we said, endangerment. So I know that we're having to finish up now, but there's so much more to talk about. I hope we get to talk again. Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate how devoted you are to this work and to helping people heal also, but really helping people feel and know that their experience matters, their abuse matters. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you for having us.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Philip and to Stacy. It's so good to hear from them again and to find out about the latest. There has been so much happening with people who were in 3HO, with people who were affected by Yogi Bhajan, otherwise known as YB, for the people who don't like to even speak his name anymore. There's so much unfortunate competition and infighting, which happens. It just happens sometimes with a lot of groups where people were very much controlled and then pushed to compete with each other, where there was a very kind of interesting hierarchy. And what I mean by interesting is that it could shift. It's like a hierarchy in quicksand, that you could move yourself up by showing your devotion, by being open to doing whatever YB told you to do, and giving up your dreams, basically, giving up your education, giving up so much, giving up your children to be sent to the schools in India. But still, if you just did anything or said anything or said no to anything after that, you would lose everything you had worked for in terms of your place in that group and your level of potential safety, emotional and spiritual, in that group. And so when people are in a group like that, they learn to jockey for position. They learn that life is about competition. And at least for some people, they are very concerned about losing their standing still after they've left. Others have put all that behind them, and they are really wanting to move on. But some really care about still being seen as good members, or at least good followers or adherents to YB and YB's teachings. And so there is a lot of dissension and tension among the former members. And that makes it hard for people to heal, makes it hard for people really to move on. It's also true that there was very little parental guidance and protection in this group, very little modeling about how to be taken care of and how to then learn that you matter and that it's important to be taken care of and what that even looks like and what that feels like. When you're in a group where the whole idea of parental attachment is seen as deranged, is seen as neurotic, is seen as needy, is seen as stupid, and is also seen as something that is the cause of damage for your children, then you learn to detach. And some parents did it more than others. Some parents did it more easily or more with more difficulty than others. But at the same time, children often felt unprotected, unsupervised, sometimes unloved. And so there is nothing neurotic about parental attachment. In fact, it is something that happens for most people naturally. And that's why there are so many people who are wounded when they have their own children, when they have gone through a parent detaching from them, either because that parent had an issue of their own or they were involved in a cult and the cult leader told them to detach because those relationships threaten the connection to the leader as your number one person, as your most important person. But even in those situations where your parents detached from you, you have your own children and find, by and large, not 100%, but by and large, that your attachment is so deep, is so total, is so natural, is so instinctive, that you don't know how you could go along with a directive to detach. And when the next generation sees that, when they see that they naturally want to protect their children, they wonder about the gravity of control that YB had over their own parents to get them to feel okay about sending them away to schools around the world where they would sometimes come back shell-shocked and malnourished and abused and with post-traumatic stress. Any system that also makes a blanket statement about all parents and what all parents need to do and what all parents are supposed to feel about their children is going to be a dangerous system, because not all parents are alike, but also not all children need the same thing. And certainly, it is never the case that all children need to be separated from their parents in order to be healthy. The idea that parents would separate from their children to protect them is also something that motivated a lot of very well-meaning, loving parents to do just that. If you can be convinced that doing something is for the other person's benefit, it makes it a lot easier to do it, unfortunately. And that is a ploy and a trick that YB enforced in the group. And that's the reasoning that was given that made it a lot more palatable for parents to do so. There are many more stories about things that happen that are being uncovered, and I hope that you will check them out. Stacy and Philip have done really beautiful work in honoring people's experiences, in making sure that their trauma, that their life doesn't go unnoticed and unrecorded and forgotten about. Thank you again. Take good care, everyone. Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.